Welcome to EAN Cast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
Hello and welcome to the EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. My name is Bernhard Steinhoff and I'm the medical director of the Cork Epilepsy Center in Germany and currently the co-chair of the scientific panel Epilepsy of the European Academy. This month's topic is apparently epilepsy and about new diagnostic and therapeutic EEG and neurostimulation approaches. And in today's number two episode, we will talk about the new developments concerning neurostimulation. The learning objectives of this episode is to learn about the established and upcoming differing approaches of neurostimulation in epilepsy treatment, to discuss the indication and risk-benefit ratio of each available and projected application. And it's so wonderful to have a pioneer and an expert of this topic, neurostimulation in epilepsy, with us, who is Christel Fong from Ghent in Belgium. And it's so good to have you as a partner here for our episode, Christel. Hello.
Hello, Bernhard. Happy to be here.
Firstly, I wanted to ask about the history a little bit, about the concept of neurostimulation epilepsy. Well, we both know this is not a very new concept, or is it a new approach?
No, you're absolutely right, Bernhard. Neurostimulation is certainly not a novel idea or a novel therapy approach, but it has become available really for neurological patients only in the past 30 years. History-wise, I think we all know that there are reports from much earlier on about interfering with your body and more particular with the nervous system using electrical fields that are externally or even internally applied. About 50 years ago, there were researchers who used, for instance, a changing magnetic field in the vicinity of the cortex and were able to induce, for instance, vertigo or phosphenes. But actually, it's only since there was an increase in the development of really smaller medical devices, pushed most likely by our colleagues from cardiology, for instance, with regards to pacemaker therapies for cardiac disorders. Only since then that also, indeed, there was a breakthrough more and more in neurology. For a long time, I think personally, we have focused very much on one part of our own brain, meaning the chemical neurotransmission, and trying to interfere with that transmission to treat our disorders, while actually a large part of our normal physiological functioning of the brain is dependent on electrical neurotransmission. And it's only now, with the miniaturized approaches of electrodes, devices, and improved technology, of course, implantables, that we are able to be where we are today, and that we can state that, you know, currently it's not a novel therapy anymore. For instance, the most frequently applied form of neurostimulation, vagus nerve stimulation, has just reached its 30th anniversary.
Great. And just for the listeners and the community and the audience we have, from a methodological point of view, could you just briefly explain the concepts of open loop and closed loop stimulation?
Yes, absolutely. There is certainly still a challenge in the mechanism of action. We don't know exactly how neurostimulation works. So in that sense, over the past years, most of the devices use what we call an open loop approach, meaning there is stimulation of a certain target in the brain. And also there are different strategies. But this is not triggered by any physiological change that is recorded from the body of the patient. So you actually just program something, like you could program also cardiac pacing to deliver some kind of stimulation to some area in the brain. Closed loop is a different approach. And of course, it is interesting from a point of view, for instance, from Parkinson's or other neuropsychiatric disorders, but it's particularly interesting in the field of epilepsy, because what we have been trying to develop for years now is a therapy that only works at the time that a symptom, in this case, a seizure occurs. And that, of course, would be for certain approaches interesting, namely that you could record abnormal activity during a seizure and then trigger a stimulation. The only device that currently allows to do that is, well, not the only one, actually. There's two of them, vagus nerve stimulation and also an intracranial form of it. The whole issue here is that we don't really predict a seizure, but most likely detect a seizure. So the field of prediction, I guess you also realize that, Bernard, you did a lot of research in that too. It's still the ultimate search in epilepsy to be able to predict a seizure. We have not been able to do that, certainly not online, and not there are no algorithms who can incorporate this into a device that senses and triggers stimulation, like in a closed loop approach.
Yeah, and that is still the fascinating perspective we are all waiting for, that it really works. And from a methodological point of work, it should work. And therefore, that would be a great breakthrough. But you mentioned already, well, that the basic device we still have, of course, is the VNS. And you mentioned that in a way, the new devices deliver some sort of closed loop approach. Can you tell me something about that?
Yes, absolutely. So indeed, the latest vagus nerve stimulation device that is available allows to deliver closed loop. And then there's another system, the responsive neurostimulation system, that is currently only available in the United States, but worthwhile mentioning. These are two devices that are able to sense seizure activity in the broad sense of the word. For the responsive neurostimulation system, that is done in the brain with intracranial electrodes that are typically located inside or in the close vicinity of an epileptogenic zone. For the vagus nerve stimulation device, this is based on changes in cardiac heart rhythm that have been investigated. And apparently, many of our seizures, more than 70-80%, are associated with an increase in heart rate that can be detected by this device. The advantage of the vagus nerve stimulation device is that it allows both open loop and closed loop to work together for patients. So that's certainly an advantage to my belief, because if you think about our whole epileptology approach or epileptogenesis approach, just delivering therapy when there is a seizure is most likely not affecting the underlying disorder. And it is strongly believed that maybe with neurostimulation, we have the opportunity to also target the underlying epileptogenesis. But for that, most likely you need longer term stimulation and neuromodulatory changes, which are not only going to be reached when you only stimulate at the time when a seizure occurs.
Well, we didn't cover yet another neurostimulation technique in epilepsy, and that is deep brain stimulation. But a lot of neurologists are aware of that in Parkinson's, for example, or a movement disorder, and it's licensed and tested in epilepsy treatment as well. Can you tell me something about the current status of DBS in epilepsy?
Absolutely. So deep brain stimulation, indeed, as you said, became available or to the interest of epileptologists soon after Professor Alim Louis Benabid did his life work in movement disorders. And due to the evolution in technology there, epileptologists started thinking, why can't we use this electrode also in the target of an epileptogenic zone? At Ghent University Hospital, we initially started with targeting the ictal onset zone and the hippocampus. But eventually, it was a study driven primarily by one of the biggest companies who is designing these electrodes and these devices, who chose the thalamus as a target to further develop. We all know that the thalamus plays an important role probably in the synchronization or spreading of epileptogenic activity. So in that sense, this network-based approach, as we can call it, vices the more ictal onset zone approach in the hippocampus was certainly also very valuable. And that is currently the only approved deep brain stimulation for therapy, apart from this responsive neurostimulation approach. So the anterior nucleus of the thalamus is targeted in this system. And this has been investigated in large randomized controlled trials. And in the meantime, also in open follow-up trials of, I think the follow-up in these patients is now longer than 7 to 8 years. And the outcome is very similar to the other neurostimulation approaches in the sense that over the long term, more than half of your patients have a reduction in seizure frequency of at least 50%, which seems a valuable addition to their ongoing drug treatment, for instance, in case that these patients are not good surgery candidates. Also with anterior nucleus thalamic stimulation, the seizure freedom rates seem to be a little bit higher compared to the other neurostimulation approaches. But there also is a little bit of concern about psychiatric side effects in the field of cognition and mood. So there is a balance and a very high need for an individual decision on what type of neurostimulation you would choose in a specific patient.
How would you judge? Well, you spoke about efficacy already and about the very promising figures we have concerning efficacy. What about the tolerability? If I'm sitting in front of a patient after 7 or 8 anti-seizure medications, I'm telling about a VNS or DBS, and he certainly asks about the tolerability. Any safety concerns?
Yeah, I think there it is very important. Although we have no comparative trials between, let's say, in Europe, vagus nerve stimulation and the brain stimulation of the anterior nucleus of the thalamus, it is fair to say that surgery for vagus nerve stimulation is less invasive compared to the brain stimulation, and that in the long term, after 7-8 years, the outcome between these two approaches is not so different. So in that sense, personally, in our center, we tend to provide or to propose both stimulation parameters, stimulation devices or approaches to the patient, but also explain to them that typically what we do is propose vagus nerve stimulation first as it is less invasive. There have been some kind of trials where it was suggested, for instance, that for temporal lobe epilepsy, that are for patients who are still have temporal lobe epilepsy but who are not good candidates for surgery, that anterior nucleus DBS would have superior efficacy, but this has not been confirmed in very large studies. So a less invasive approach first. With regards to tolerability, the side effects are, I think, similar in the sense that from a point of infection rate, of course, you have a little bit of a higher complication rate related to the surgery. With implanting a deep brain electrode, there is a risk of inducing an intracranial bleeding, and that's something that we see also with ANT-DBS in 0.5% to 1% of the patients, and this is something that doesn't occur with VNS. The largest complication with vagus nerve stimulation related to surgery is vocal cord paralysis, but this happens only also in a limited number of patients and typically recovers very well also.
In the long term of those therapies, what would you say is the major mistake of the neurologists having patients with stimulation showing up after 1 year? Well, we both know that we have to tell the patients that it needs a couple of months until we can judge the efficacy of the neurostimulation devices. But a patient shows up after 1 year of VNS, has the same frequency of seizures, and you know what I'm asking, basically. What is the major mistake of the neurologist then?
Yes, well, it is not the easiest question, because if there is no response after 1 year with neurostimulation, you get concerned, your patient gets concerned, and there are non-responders. In about 25 to 30% of the patients, there is little response. What is important here is not only to look at seizure frequency as an outcome parameter, to keep titrating your patient. You need to try and further optimize their stimulation parameters. That's highly important, because certainly I have given my personal advice to centers that called me and said, listen, we have 15 patients, but only one responder, for instance. What's happening here? And I arrived there and all the patients were at 0.75 milliamps. So keep programming, but also have a look at the other potential advantages of particular vagus nerve stimulation. Are your patients more alert, more awake? In that sense, you can already have a feeling, a sense, whether at least the stimulation is giving them some benefit. But it's a bit of a challenge if you have a non-responder.
And the last point I want to cover is about a new neurostimulation technique we have now. And I know that you were participating in the studies I did as well with the epicranial stimulation. What about that? And who would be the ideal candidate for that?
Yeah, very good question. So this epicranial form of stimulation is actually in an analog of the transcranial direct current stimulation, which is basically a form of non-invasive stimulation. We have a lot of research and trials going on to further develop this for patients because, of course, the non-invasive approach for a patient would have a lot of advantages. But it's a challenge, again, the search for the optimal target, the search for the optimal stimulation parameters, the search for the optimal patient. But with transcranial direct current stimulation, there were some initial positive results. And this has been transformed into an implantable system that is minimally invasive, as we can call it, in the sense that it is implanted in the patient's body. The electrode is implanted outside the skull, but under the skin. The generator or the pacemaker device that delivers the energy for stimulation is again implanted in the thoracic region of the patient. The ideal patient is most likely the one who has a targetable region, epileptogenic zone, in the neocortex. But that cannot be resected for various reasons, overlap with functional tissue, maybe two or three regions where one is most active. I strongly believe that these are the best patients for this therapy.
Yeah, I agree totally. I just saw a guy who has a cortical dysplasia, focal cortical dysplasia in the motor cortex and an awful epilepsy, many seizures, but we know exactly where the epileptogenic lesion is. And in my mind, and certainly in your mind too, that might be the ideal candidate. I follow one of those patients for almost 1 year now, and he seems to benefit. So that is a major, major step forward, I guess. So, last question, Crystal. What about the future of neurostimulation in epilepsy? What do we expect during the next, 5 years?
Mm-hmm. Very good question. I think what we should do research in is further investigate the electrokinetics and electrodynamics of neurostimulation. We need to know what neurostimulation does to the brain and what the brain does to the delivered electricity or magnetic fields. That's what we should focus on if we want to exceed the current efficacy rates. I personally strongly believe in combined and personalized approaches, combined in the broad sense of the word, surgery, drugs, neurostimulation, because that's how our body works. Personalized approaches, I think that's clear. Every patient is different. I cannot believe that one type of neurostimulation parameters for vagus nerve stimulation is going to solve any type of epilepsy or any type of patient. So this personalized approach should be further developed. For patients, I hope that the non-invasive stimulation approaches eventually become available. That's clear. Why? Because it has for them a lot of advantages. And I think, Bernard, you certainly know about my personal struggle in the past years to bring my ideas on neurostimulation forward to help patients. And my visionary idea there is that I won't need a lot of help anymore in the near future, as all this progress that is being made with brain-computer interfaces and with the Elon Musk approaches and all the spin-offs from his company, that soon patients will come to us and will demand neurostimulation before they will be treated or we want to be treated with drugs.
Okay, that's great. That's a great final remark for our session. And this might be the take-home message, but the other take-home message I think is very, very important, that in some patients one should consider an additional or complementary technique like neurostimulation, not necessarily as the number 12 or number 13 or number 14 in the ranking of some anti-seizure medications, but in some suitable candidates, it might be a good idea to consider neurostimulation very early, as you said, in the course of the epilepsy treatment. So thank you very much for this wonderful discussion, and thanks to the audience, of course, and the organizers. And take care, and bye-bye.
Thank you, Bernhard. It was a pleasure.
This has been EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. EAN Cast Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.